The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Hey guys, we're really excited to announce that our live show in Boston with True Crime Obsessed is back on for July 31st, 2021. It was originally scheduled for March of 2020, and that didn't happen. So here we are.
Right. We all know how it went down when we were all together in Brooklyn, New York, way back in October of 2019. And then the world stopped. We were not able to get together with our friends at True Crime Obsessed, Jillian and Patrick. Also, Maggie Freeling will be joining us. We got the band back together at the Wilbur Theater. You can go to thewilbur.com for your tickets. And if you had purchased tickets to the previous shows, current ticket holders, because of the venue change, your tickets will be refunded, and then you'll have exclusive advanced access to purchase tickets to the new show. You should have received two emails, one confirming the refund and one with the link to purchase the new tickets.
And of course, True Crime Obsessed covers true crime documentaries. And in this show, they cover the disappearance of Maura Murray, Oxygen documentary that Lance and I were a part of. See you at the Wilbur. Anchor is flat out the easiest way to make a podcast. Anchor gives you everything you need in one place for free, which you can use right from your computer or even your phone. Creation tools allow you to record and edit your podcast so it sounds great. They'll distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard everywhere, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and many more. You can easily make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. So download the Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started now. You are listening to Crawl Space on the Crawl Space Media Network. If you like this show, you'll love Missing, which is also hosted by us.
Missing started as Missing Maura Murray, and now it continues raising awareness for all missing people. And we also have an entire network of shows you'll love. Check them out at crawlspace-media.com.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
Tim, if I was any better, I would be our guest today. How are you?
I am doing well, Lance. Yes, and our guest, the very impressive Toby Kirschman of DNAinvestigations.com. We did a panel with her only last month in Saratoga Springs, New York. She is living out there now. She has got a really impressive history in DNA, in genetic genealogy. She's even helped with the Golden State Killer.
And what a wonderful connection to make. What a wonderful relationship to have. The panel that we did in Saratoga Springs, big shout out to those over there at Saratoga Living. They're the ones that planned the event that took place at Putnam Place. Hopefully we can get back there again and have another panel, maybe even get Toby back up there. But if you're interested in what she does, go to DNAinvestigations.com. And the mission of DNA Investigations is to bring genetic genealogy services to local law enforcement and members of the community, which is a really bold and sort of audacious type mission to have. I mean, she is going in there and saying, this is something that'll work, and you kind of need to reassess the previous way in which you've done business.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting conversation we have, learning more about the whole process and how civilians can even work and help law enforcement, which, you know, is something that's always interesting to us, Lance.
Sure is.
Okay, so I hope you enjoy this conversation with Toby Kirschman. And before we play the interview, we just want to remind you about our upcoming show at the Wilbur on July 31st, 2001. We are going to be there at the Wilbur Theater in Boston with True Crime Obsessed. Of course, that's Patrick Hines and Jillian Pensavale and Maggie Freeling of Unjust and Unsolved and Murder in Alliance, Lance. And we're all going to be on stage talking about the Oxygen documentary, The Disappearance of Maura Murray.
So whoever wants tickets to see us there, make sure to go to The Wilbur, that's thewilbur.com, and you just have to scroll down like just a little bit. I think we're like the third show there to purchase tickets. That is Saturday, July 31st, 7 p.m., and you don't want to miss it at the historic Wilbur Theater in Boston, thewilbur.com.
Okay, we'll see you there, everybody. Hope you enjoy this interview with Toby Kirschman. Make sure to follow us on social media and check out the links in the show notes. Thanks a lot.
And why don't you swing on over to our website at crawlspace-media.com and check out all the other shows that we represent over there and the new stuff coming up, as well as the back catalog of quality programming.
Welcome to the podcast, Toby Kirschman. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for joining us. Before we get into our topic of the day, how fun was Saratoga Springs?
Did you enjoy it?
It was amazing. I think the combination of being on that panel with all of you was truly humbling. And we learned so much. Couple that with, oh my goodness, I'm looking at people's full faces in a crowd and everyone is just hanging out. It was so awesome.
Yeah, I know. It's been a while, right? For everybody. Yeah, it was great. I hope you guys come back. I have some work ideas for you.
Ooh,
I'd love to hear about those. Yeah, okay. We will definitely be back. Definitely up for more collaboration with you and in Saratoga Springs. Yeah, we love that area.
Oh, good. Yeah, it's beautiful here. So pretty.
Please tell us about your background. You are in DNA, and I want to know more about that.
So it starts back in California. I was originally from California, New York girl now. I worked for the DNA laboratory for the state of California for about 10 years. And in 2017, we decided to move out here to New York. My husband and I, he's from New York. And I was a criminalist for the state of California for that 10 years. And then I decided to come out here for better weather, better life. You know, you can afford a home, stuff like that. And I wasn't sure when I got here whether I was going to do forensics or not. But I thought, oh, I could teach. There's a lot of stuff that I could do. You know, I'm just going to go for it. And so when I came out here, I worked for a little bit, about a year and a half, at the Forensic Investigation Center. And that was, that's down in Albany. And that's affiliated with the New York State Police. So I did that for a little bit. And then they started to get interested in doing genetic genealogy, which is what I'm interested in doing. I took a class, and the director was in the same class, and one of the supervisors was in that class on, you know, learning how to do genetic genealogy. And then COVID hit and everybody went home. We were all working from home, and that program never got up and running again. So I skedaddled. I started DNA Investigations, and I am hell-bent on getting some law enforcement agencies to try this in their own hands and solve some cases. So that's my spiel.
That's fantastic, and that is a quite an undertaking with the work you're doing at DNA Investigations. And I probably should know the answer to this. You said you're a criminalist. How is that different than a criminologist or my brain doesn't compute something.
No, I know that. Yeah, it probably should be standardized just so people understood it better. But in California, forensic scientists are called criminalists. And then if you do criminology, that's like the study of crime. So that's more like a sociological and a psychological approach to learning about crime and why people do it, or like demographics and stuff. And then a criminalist is the scientist that performs the work, the analysis. So they could do like, you know, work on blood or, you know, toxicology, firearms.
Wow.
That makes sense?
Yeah. How did you get involved in it?
So I was doing biotechnology, and I had a friend who was doing forensics. And I said, oh my gosh, biotechnology is kind of boring. You know, it's not like really cool. And she said, why don't you try forensics? And she said, you probably will like it better. There's a little bit more, you can care about the victim a little bit more. Yeah. So I gave that a try, and it's definitely true. So I switched over from hard science to forensics.
And how is that true that you end up caring about the victim more?
Oh, well, you know, you can see what kinds of crime is happening around you. And if you're a forensic scientist, you know that you can be part of solving it. Just, you know, figuring out the yes from the no, you know, putting the pieces in place and doing it well. There, you know, there's a lot of job satisfaction. It's just another public service, you know. So if you're big on that, forensics is a satisfying job.
And you said that you hail from California, correct?
Yes. Yep.
And you have a bit of a background there with a certain serial killer in California, correct?
I do. Yeah.
Do tell.
Anyone in law enforcement from the past four decades does.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Because that case, obviously the Golden State Killer, that case spans so many different labs. Is that why?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
And you worked in the state lab, so you've dealt with a lot of different
agencies. Yeah. Yeah. And everyone was so frustrated, and they started to get a clue. He was originally called the East Area Rapist. And that was where he started off. And that was in the Sacramento area. And then he kind of got all these other names when his crimes started to link to each other. You know, like the Santa Barbara area was starting to match, and you know, some things even from LA. The whole state was after him after a while.
What do you think that does to somebody's ego as him to know like how many people at this point he knows, how many people and how many agencies, how many members of law enforcement, of the public? I mean, because of his reign of murder, all of these advancements have been made with geotargeting and DNA profiling. And do you think that anything like, do you think that gives him an inflation of ego?
I do.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I bet he probably felt pretty slick.
Yeah, I mean, because you're getting away with it for so long, it's almost like he saw, I don't want to sound like callous, but it's almost as if he would think that he saw it as some sort of accomplishment, even though he was caught.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah, I know. And there were so many people that tried different things. I mean, it was really frustrating. So he must have loved that. Like, California was one of the earlier adopters of the arrestee provision, which is just when there is a felony arrest, you know, the DNA is taken. And that was to find him. Like that was, the politician that really put that proposition on the map was a guy named Harrington. And he funded that whole proposition. He was from Orange County, I think. And he's like, we have to get, and he was the one, he had, I think it was his niece was a victim. So he was, you know, privately driven to make sure that, you know, we had every like resource that we needed, you know, to try to, you know, just cast a wide net and not have any missing spots where people could get away. So, I mean, the arrestee provision was started in California because of him, basically.
Impressive.
Yeah.
And was that sort of a conscious thing trying to get this person who had been involved in so many of these crimes? It was sort of known that a lot of them were the same person at that point?
Yep. Yeah. And the more that the cases were connecting, the more frustrated we got. We even started another program too. One of the theories is that he had passed away while in prison. So we started a program where we collected, you know, DNA from prisons, or the coroners sometimes would keep a sample. You know, we just would do all these crazy things to, you know, get as much DNA that was lawfully owed as we could. And we solved a lot of cases, right? The arrestee provision and the it was the deceased DNA databank program. I mean, that was like, we solved a lot of crimes, but not the one that we were trying to.
What's that feel like? How does it, I mean, well, Tim and I obviously know because we're professionals in the law enforcement.
Piece of cake. We solve cases every day.
I mean, I solve cases for breakfast. Well, what does it feel like though, when you put all of this work and research and energy into collecting this data to identify somebody and then you get the answer? How does that feel?
Well, are you talking about succeeding or failing?
Well, let's start with succeeding.
Okay. The succeeding part was like really, really awesome. I mean, but it was also a gut punch for all of the standard law enforcement, because it was not solved through our traditional route. At the DNA laboratory, we tried to solve this case and didn't. It was the detectives at Sacramento County DA's office that did the genetic genealogy and found him. And so, I mean, I don't know. There are these absolutely two different camps. One of them worked and one of them didn't. And that's what drove me so hard. Like nobody should be putting a lot of energy into this old kind of like way of, you know, solving DNA crimes, or they should keep it up, but we should be absolutely doing the new stuff like as much as we can. So.
Yeah. And what does that entail? Because you had one experience in California and I imagine a much different one so far in New York, because I would imagine they're all different, right?
Yeah. So it hasn't really started here in New York, this newer kind of DNA. I'll call it genetic genealogy. And it's instead of using the traditional law enforcement DNA analysis, sequencing is used. And so the DNA from a case like evidence would have to be sent to a new laboratory, not like an old fashioned state run lab. But some of the state labs and some of the law enforcement laboratories they're all panicking right now and they're getting their equipment all up and running. But so evidence nowadays gets sent for this new sequencing, right? And when you get that data, you can look at DNA matches, just like in Ancestry, just like in 23andMe, right? A lot of people are familiar with that nowadays. And so if you use that methodology of looking for DNA matches, you can find the cousins of a killer or your crime scene, whatever your crime scene DNA is. And when you have the cousins and you map family trees, you can work back around, kind of like reverse engineer, and identify the identity of the person that left that sample at the crime scene. And so that's what I'm pushing everyone here to give it a try, you know, with their cold cases, like with that Sheila Shepherd case, that's going to be a really good thing for them to try too, you know, so it's really promising, really exciting.
Well, you said that state labs were panicking. What is causing them to panic? The fact that everything is moving in a certain direction and they need to catch up?
Yeah, yeah. So it's nobody's fault, but the reason that all of the sudden they're handed this investigative tool and they're handed it and they're so far behind is because of all the people who have been buying Ancestry DNA kits and all those kits. So people that have been putting their money into those businesses, those companies have just turned around and like their sequencing has just been, it's been improving and the technology is just vast. I mean, right, even in your time, sequencing the human genome, I mean, when it first started, right, it was like 200,000. No, it was a million. I don't know. It was like a lot of money. Nobody could do it. And now if you hit it, if you hit a weekend sale, you can get an Ancestry or another kit for like $49. You can have your own genome sequenced for $49. I mean, it's not the entire genome, but so that's how fast it is. Now, like everybody can do it. Everybody can, you know, can do this, right? So all of a sudden this, the police laboratories and the law enforcement laboratories, they've been doing this old system and all of a sudden they can fight crimes and solve the cases using DNA, but it's this rapidly advanced sequencing system that, you know, research laboratories and academic laboratories, and they've had like years of experience with this. And so now the law enforcement laboratories are kind of like, wow, oh my gosh, we have to get this up and running immediately, like yesterday, because a lot of law enforcement agencies rely on like a bigger place, a bigger laboratory to send their samples. So that's the panic, is that the labs are like, oh my gosh, we have to do this quickly.
Right. It's a lot of work trying to make everything sort of electronic, I'm sure. And how does that even work, right? So if there's, you know, DNA from a killer in a 40-year-old case, how does that get to a computer and then sort of run? I assume it would be run against the CODIS database before it would be taken out to a different database, right?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. So the best way that genetic genealogy works is to have a sample in CODIS already through this kind of more, you know, traditional DNA analysis. So if you have like a 40-year-old case and there was like a bloody knife or whatever, and you have suspect DNA uploaded to CODIS, you have to start from scratch, take DNA, start all over again, and develop a SNP profile. You can't use any, unfortunately, it's so new. You have to start with the source material again. You could start with a DNA extract if that was left over from the very first time, you know, the bloody, you know, knife was processed or whatever, that would work. But you really have to start with the bare DNA cells again. So you get a sample up into CODIS, and that's awesome. Then if there's no hit in CODIS, you take those DNA cells from whatever the evidence was, like blood, and you develop a SNP profile. You send it to one of these companies, just like Ancestry, but not. There's a few companies out there now are ready to handle law enforcement samples. They're ISO 17025 certified, and they're, you know, they have, you know, qualified analysts, blah, blah, blah. They're ready. They're ready to take law enforcement samples, and they process them and get this new DNA kind of profile ready. They will upload that here in the state of New York. It's important that they upload that raw DNA right into these new databases that you were mentioning. And so instead of CODIS, these new ones are called GEDmatch, ftDNA, Family Tree DNA. And there's a new one called DNA Solves as well through Othram. I know you guys like Othram. David Milliman, he's the best. So it goes into kind of like this new route, or like, you know, everything is still, we're just really piecing it together. It's still not really awesome and, you know, proven and just everything. But, you know, all the law enforcement agency needs to do is see the matches. So the investigator is sitting there, they have a 40-year-old cold case, There was a sample in CODIS, but it didn't hit. And now they log in to Family Tree DNA and they look for cousins. When they see those cousins, that's when I step in to help them. And I'm going to be doing law enforcement training, coming up here. So my goal is to teach any law enforcement agents that want to learn this, to take those cousins and like kind of reverse engineer the trees to pull down some suspects. And then you have leads, you have new leads to follow for your case.
And so that is what the mission of DNA investigations is. So that's where, when you say that's where I come in, you're speaking of the DNA investigations.
Yeah. That's where I come in. I feel really strongly about, I feel like detectives and investigators deserve to solve their own crimes, you know, that they've been working on. One option, if they wanted to, you know, take advantage of genetic genealogy, they could send the DNA away and hire that same company to do the genetic genealogy. But sometimes your matches are so good that you don't even need to build a family tree. For example, if I told you that if you like open up the screen and you take a look and I say, hey, detective, you have a sibling match, you wouldn't really even need to build a family tree for that, right? You would just immediately start asking the question, how many brothers and sisters does this person have? And which of them fit the description of the suspect if there is one, right? So some of them are really, really awesome. And so I believe that the law enforcement agencies should have the glory of those really awesome, easy ones. And if you hire a company to do that for you, they will do maybe 10 hours of work. And if it's really hard, they'll send it back. They'll send, you know, they'll do their 10 hours and then they'll send the case back and say, okay, good luck with this super hard one. So yeah, I think the law enforcement agencies should learn how to do this.
Yeah. And you said that you were hellbent on getting law enforcement to adopt this. What are some of your tactics?
Yeah. So I heard the retired Saratoga Springs police chief the other day giving a brown bag seminar on a book that he wrote about gangsters like 100 years ago in Saratoga Springs, like with the casinos and stuff. There was kind of a big underground presence. And he had done just all this research on that. So he was so personable and he was retired. And I was like, oh, I need someone just like that to step in and see if he can help me. I'm like, I need this guy to help me. So I met with him the other day and he said, you need to get in front of law enforcement agencies and do some training. So he is going to help me do a pilot run and it's going to be free. And we're going to feel it out. We're going to see how many people, cause it is hard. It's hard work to do genetic genealogy. So not every detective, crime analyst is going to be interested, but I do believe a lot of them will, because sometimes people are really like, they have a drive to solve a case. So it's interesting to see, you know, how far their minds they'll push themselves. I just want to give them that chance. So that's my first tactic anyway.
Is there any concern that it won't be adapted because it's adding an element of work, another element where, they have to, yeah, you know what
pay
I'm saying?
For
like,
it.
Yeah, now they have to fund it and they have to hire people, like train people.
Yep. Yeah. That is a hurdle. And so, I'm going to pitch it like we all have to deal with this hurdle, right? Like every, 1 or 2 years, you have to get a new cell phone.
Right.
And it's always uncomfortable a little bit because you're like, oh, I just feel like I got to learn my last one. And then you have to like Google how to do something because you don't know how to turn it off or like whatever, right? Sorry, this is how it is. And the funny thing is that in the most expensive way, genetic genealogy isn't necessarily, I mean, a super expensive case would be 10 grand. And you have to weigh that against the price of keeping a cold case open.
Right. Okay. So there's a good, one plus one is two type thing. Like, I wonder how much it costs to track down Joseph DeAngelo. If this was, if this was back then, that's, what was that, 40 something years of an investigation, and Sheila Shepherd, you just have these cases that are out there.
No.
What kind of resources are going into those cases when you can start checking them off the list a little bit sooner? I wonder what the breakdown is financially there.
Yeah, I think it's, there are some agencies that are collecting and keeping data too for cost effective, for, return on investment, ROI studies, so that's good. That'll help. But the other thing is that there's a lot of grants. There are federal grants, given through the BJA, Bureau of Justice Administration or something like that, right? And there are so many grants. There's grants for prosecution, there's cold case, there's exoneration. I mean, the federal government it's broadband. They're like, please use genetic genealogy. They've already issued their statement. They have a like a 8-page document out that they put out in 2019, like the rules and regulations. So they're all for it. And it's just, you have to think of it differently. You have to start paying for it differently. You got to just do it. One of those things.
Yeah, you got to just rip the Band-Aid off, right, and get started. Yeah. But it's a long, tedious task. And how can we help, or how can, our listeners or civilians help?
So calls and emails are always good. Voicing support. So education is the problem right now. A lot of the law enforcement agencies that I talked to right when I was deciding on whether or not to do this company, some of them had heard of it. Some of them hadn't heard of it. Some of them had heard of the Golden State Killer case. Some of them hadn't. And so I don't think that they know that this exists, a lot of them. So definitely that's my biggest hurdle right now, is getting the word out there. And I think they're going to be surprised that once they learn that it's here to stay, they're also going to be surprised that it's not run by their, but like the same as their other DNA system, through a state lab, through CODIS, the federal government. They're going to be surprised that they're the ones that will control how fast it goes, and that they can step in and solve it themselves if they want, or pay someone else to do it. I think that they're going to be surprised when they learn all of this, but so it's just new. So my biggest hurdle is, getting the education out, getting the word out, and just so that we can stop the ignorance clock a little bit and be like, this is going to land in your lap sooner or later. You just got to pick, is it going to be sooner or is it going to be later?
Right. And is this part of the training that you perform?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. With the training, I would like them to know that this is out there and it's not going to go away. I one analogy I use is like the cassette tape, going to the CD player, going to the MP3, like it doesn't make any sense to ever go back, in a museum way. That's kind of cool if you keep an example of some of these things around, but there is no, okay. So when you do STRs in the CODIS fashion, you get, like a couple dozen, less than 25 pieces of information on an individual, and that's what you're comparing. When you do a SNP analysis, there's somewhere around 1 million. I think an average would be like 700,000 pieces of information about someone's identity. And so those two things aren't really comparable. You can really nail down who someone is, and there's no question.
Do you get a lot of aha moments when you do the training from law enforcement once they realize those numbers?
You know, so our first pilot run is going to be in August.
Oh, okay.
So I hope, but you know, with the few law enforcement individuals that I've spoken with on the phone, yes. But it's almost like a really embarrassed, like, oh no, like shocked, aha. Like my brain can't even wrap my mind around what you're saying, kind of an aha. You know, I think they're pretty freaked out.
But I guess that's a good thing because they're listening to you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, it's like that hurdle though, I think, trying to get everyone to understand. I know for me, things take like repetition to really kind of sink in until I feel like I understand what is going on. And I wonder if that's the same with a lot of law enforcement agencies, you know?
Yeah, no, I do believe that's true. Definitely. Yeah. Especially when it's a complex topic that involves science and money and, you know, in the end, also their job performance is super different. They'll have to learn genetic genealogy, and then they'll have to decide when they find, like, actually who did this thing. You know, they'll have to ask themselves, do I want to collect a surreptitious DNA sample, or do I want to confront the individual and say, would you be willing to give, you know, here's a DNA kit or whatever, you know, would you be willing to give a DNA sample? Right. Which also works. I don't know why it works, but people will do that. So far. I think they're like, oops, I just got caught. I might as well. Yeah. So, and then if they've passed away, the investigator will have to ask themselves, well, should we exhume the body and confirm it that way? So a lot of that's happening. I'm not sure if you guys have seen that happening lately. Yeah. Oh, and there's a lot of exonerations that are happening too. When we find out like the exact, you know, name and identity of the person and someone else is doing time for them.
And have you been directly involved in those exonerations?
No, nothing like that yet. Hopefully, but I think that the federal government has done an excellent job preparing because they already have grants out there for this. If you take a look at what there are grants for, you can get an idea for how serious an entity is about something. I mean, they took a look at how this is going to affect law enforcement agencies, and they're backing it with money, which means that the law enforcement agencies, that they should embrace it. They shouldn't be scared of it. I mean, yeah, they might have, you know, they might have convicted someone that they shouldn't have. But better to find that out and free someone than keep an innocent individual in jail.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com. Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Big thanks to our sponsor, BetterHelp. Lance, it's summertime. The weather is better than usual up here in the Northeast. That's nice. The sunshine makes me happy. Being active, getting out there, that's great. But sometimes I still have those down days. what do you do when you're having a down day?
Yeah, Tim, you really nailed it there. It's so good to be outside. It's so good to be around people, nice weather. But, you know, there are those days where you do still get down. And try not to have those days affect your happiness. Try not to have those days prevent you from achieving your goals. You mentioned at the beginning of this, our fine sponsor. We are sponsored by BetterHelp, and they are the people who can help you to get over those humps.
BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can connect in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient. Start communicating in under 24 hours. Lance, come on, this is great.
It's great. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling, and you can send a message to your professional counselor at any time, and you will get a timely and thoughtful response from your professional counselor. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions. This is all done without ever having to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room.
And BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. And it's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available.
This service is available for clients worldwide, and there's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas.
No, but that range is so broad.
I'm just going to name some of the areas that these licensed professional counselors are specialized in. We got depression, stress, if you have anxiety, relationship matters, sleeping, trauma. Tim, nail a couple of these.
Anger, family conflicts, LGBTQ matters, grief, self-esteem. Anything you share is confidential. Lance, it's convenient. It's professional. It's affordable.
And we could go on and on here, which we do, but don't take our long-winded words for it. Go check out the testimonials they post daily on their website.
And it's not a crisis line, but in fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. And we want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at BetterHelp.com/CurlSpace.
How could over 1 million people be wrong, Tim? Join them, the people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp. HELP.com/crawlspace.
Now, is there some competition in the world of databases? Say, like, because it seems odd to me, and I'm not in this world, so I don't know. But, you know, as a civilian, if you get your DNA, you can upload it to this database and that database, or you know, you have to make sure you allow law enforcement to, you know, you have to opt in. Mm-hmm. With the check
right.
mark. So
yeah.
Am I reading that correctly? Are there different databases for the reason because people want to have the biggest one out there? And like, how is there a way to combine or just make a massive one?
Yeah, I'm not really sure about that. I haven't talked to anyone at CODIS, but I would like to reach out and just see what they might be doing and different thoughts that they might have, because ostensibly, if they hadn't been so blindsided, you know, they could have the answer to that. Like, they could be supplying the database for law enforcement rather than GEDmatch, Family Tree DNA, and DNA Solves. You know, so I bet they're thinking about this all the time, talking about this all the time. Yeah, and it's wild that. That we're using these, you know, public databases. It's just very different than we've ever done before.
And you also mentioned on your website that you help people looking to solve family mysteries. What is that? What's that aspect of DNA investigations?
Yeah. So tomorrow, for example, I'm going to be talking to two individuals. One of them I have helped narrow down who his father might be. And he was adopted. So that was, I don't think I will actually find the name of his father, because when you're working your way back down the family tree, if there are a couple of adoptions in a row, It's really hard to know. It's hard to provide an answer for an individual. So, but I've got a lot of ideas, and every day the database grows. Like every day that I look at his matches, there's another, like, you know, dozen or whatever every day. It's incredible. It's just right now, it's just the results today. And I mean, if anyone has a family mystery, they should never say, oh, I'm done with this, you know, because it's just a matter of time. It's really crazy. And then there's another woman that I'll be meeting tomorrow to talk about different questions in her family. Like there was some family lore about them being related to some royalty. And so she wanted to have that investigated, and some different ethnicity questions too.
Interesting.
I call Lance Prince Lance.
Yeah, I was just going to say, is it, do they share the same Reinsterna last name or?
No.
No.
What's your story? What's your backstory, Prince?
No, I'm not. I'm not a prince. I'm hardly. I'm a pauper.
Okay.
We still call him Prince Lance, though. It's just a fun nickname.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Very good.
It's totally untrue. We've never called me that.
So let me ask you guys a question. When did you first hear about genetic genealogy and like a different way of solving cases? Like, when did that first come out of the woodworks for you guys?
Gee, I mean, everyone talks about the Golden State Killer as the first time it's really become sort of mainstream. And I'm pretty sure that would be the first time we started talking about it consistently on our airwaves. But Lance, was there any other case before that I'm not thinking of right now?
That involved DNA or genealogy,
well,
or both?
Yeah, genealogy, I mean, specifically.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the first time hearing about DNA, period, was the O.J. Simpson case.
Right.
But that wasn't, that wasn't genealogy. Yeah, I think Golden State Killer was the one where it was like, oh, wow, that's some impressive stuff. Like, seeing how it's all the path, the route all of the routes that needed to be taken to get to that one destination was so impressive.
Yeah. 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 That was the case that really put it on the map.
Yeah. And so when, how like hectic was that for you during that time? What was there a lot of stuff like going in and out and a lot of kind of hurry up and waiter or anything like that?
So when I left the laboratory, it was in 2017, and I would say that the mood was, oh my gosh, just hurry up and wait. We were always hunting, you know, for that, always hoping. It was like, you know, oh, maybe this is going to be it. Maybe this is going to be it. Always, always, always. Right. And then, I think probably in late 2017, it probably went dark. That's when I moved, like right when I moved out to New York is probably when the Sacramento investigators stopped, like, you know, talking to the California Library so much. So I was the go-to person when I was out there in California. And, you know, when I moved out here to New York, I don't know this, but I bet that like, I would have seen the buzz, like just go dark, you know, stop. And what was happening was the, Kirk and Monica and, you know, teamed up with a couple of other people and Barbara Ray Venter, you know, the genetic genealogy badass, and created that little 5-person team to do the genetic genealogy. And then they solved that case in 4 months, just them. And they were having like, oh my God, moments like left and right. And they didn't even know what they were doing because it was, you know, doing it for the first time, really. And so, you know, they were like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, I'm guessing, right? I mean, I've talked to Monica since then. She's my friend that works there. She's an investigative assistant for the Sac County DA. And I think that they were really quiet when they were doing all of this. And as soon as it came out and, you know, it opened up, all of my friends that were criminalists, the traditional way working at the laboratory, like, you know, through the CODIS unit, we were just all calling each other, emailing each other, you know, texting, just like, what's going on? What's going on? How did this guy get caught? Cause he didn't get caught through us. He didn't get caught through CODIS. And so, you know, we were just like, what is going on? What is going on? You know, we just couldn't believe it, couldn't understand it. And then, and they couldn't say anything. They had to wait, you know, be careful, you know, through his arrest and everything until it all came out. And then I was able to talk to my friend Monica that worked on the team and say, how did this happen? And she explained genetic genealogy to me. So yeah, that was just, it was a gut punch for the entire state of California. So that's what I was trying to explain earlier at the beginning when you asked me. It's you're so happy on, you know, on one side of the coin, but then you're crestfallen because everything that you've tried your whole life didn't work. I actually have some stats here. I don't know which one of you was bringing this up, like how much money, like the difference is, you know, and this is actually from the Golden State Killer case. Do you want me to throw some numbers out at you?
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Okay. So, you know, using traditional law enforcement, and this information came from Steve Kramer, who heads up the genetic genealogy for the FBI out of Los Angeles. And he was one of the members, one of the five on the Golden State Killer team. So, you know, he compiled these numbers and in the old fashioned way, you know, detective work and sending, you know, collecting DNA and just sending it through CODIS. That case went on for about 43 cold case years. It involved 15 separate law enforcement agencies. It employed 650 full and part-time detectives in all. There's an estimate of about 200,000 man hours put in by law enforcement personnel from the state of California. There's an estimate cost of about $10 million altogether for all the resources. 8,000 subjects were considered. 300 individuals were surveyed and had swabs taken from them, you know, to possibly be the suspect. And zero was the amount of people that were found or leads that were developed, you know, out of all of that. And then when you look at the exact same thing on the, you know, using genetic genealogy, it cost about $217 to buy the DNA kit. It included five people. It took 63 days to find a suspect, which is counting from the time the DNA went into the database and they found the matches. And they came down with just one suspect. One suspect was turned over, just one name. Not even like, here's a list of suspects. This project handed over one name. So all of that compared to all of those other numbers. And so, yeah.
It's impressive.
Yeah, you really it's can't impressive. Argue with it.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you look at like the big picture plan, like a long scope of the whole thing, you mentioned how many police officers were employed during that period of time, and that's not going to get lost. You know what I mean? If the DNA, if the genealogy is put into effect, that's not going to get lost because crime just doesn't stop. It's just you're now solving more of it. And so 600 and something law enforcement officials don't have to be assigned to one particular case. Now you can split that up. Now they can be assigned to multiple cases. Now, hopefully, these cases don't go cold so fast and stay cold so long.
Yep. Yeah.
Ah. So are you going to be tackling the Sheila Shepherd, the only unsolved murder in Saratoga Springs history?
Yeah. Oh, I'd love to. Yeah. So I would love to, you know, have a conversation with the law enforcement in Saratoga Springs. And I'm hoping that they, you know, that they're open to learning about genetic genealogy. You know, the most important thing is that you find DNA. But, you know, another thing that you have to, I mean, it's overwhelming for detectives and for law enforcement agencies, because you have to know, for example, that now, like in 2020, you could, you know, do genetic genealogy on a hair, not just a, like rootless hair. And it used to be that you had to have a root on a hair and then you could do DNA. So law enforcement now is tasked with knowing what, you know, what they can and can't do as far as 2021 is concerned, and then going back to the cold cases and re-scanning per these new technologies, right? So, it's a bit daunting, but you can't ignore it. Ignorance is not the right way out of this. So help is available, and it's going to take creative, you know, thinking. It's going to take creative funding, and it's going to take people. And this is, I know you guys butt up against this too all the time. And, you know, it's going to take law enforcement agencies loosening up a little bit and relaxing, you know, and kind of opening up to new and different ways of doing things. And, you know, and that's hard for them, right? But now is the time, I think.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it just, like you said, it's going to take some time and some adapting has to happen. But I mean, the history of law enforcement has been generations who are adapting, you know, it's generation after generation. They adapt to something new. I mean, back, it wasn't even that long ago where you could have a gunfight on the street and it was like, well, who drew first? You right. know what I mean? And then, right. at some point people are like, maybe that's not how we should police.
That's where let's take this outside comes from, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we don't have a straight up duel in the center of town. You know, so
I don't know. I kind of want to go back to that, but
oh, so yeah. I think let's as barbaric as possible.
No, just kidding. But well, this is really fascinating, and I'm thrilled to learn a little bit more about this, and I want to know more. And let's connect offline and see how we can collaborate further when we get our butts back to Saratoga Springs.
Yeah, great. I love it. Thank you so much, you guys. This was great. And to all of your listeners, thank you so much. And just support this topic wherever you can. Support the law enforcement trying new stuff.
Thank
Fantastic.
You.
Fantastic. And we're now honorary criminalists, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. Perfect. Great. When a person goes missing, their loved ones often find themselves overcome with worry and grief. Bruce Maitland started the 501c3 nonprofit organization Private Investigations for the Missing because he knows this feeling all too well.
When Bruce's daughter Brianna disappeared in March 2004, he was surrounded by licensed private investigators dedicated to finding her. Now his mission is to provide dedicated private investigators at no cost to other families of the missing, desperate for answers but without the financial means.
Private Investigations for the Missing needs your help. To read the mission statement, make a donation, and keep up with our blog, visit us at investigationsforthemissing.org and follow us at PI for the Missing on Twitter and Facebook and Investigations for the Missing on Instagram.
Because forever is too long to wait.